Joe Kennedy running to be the only true ginger in Congress, huh?
Who are the fake gingers?
I don't know. There aren't that many people who are like as carrot toppy as he is.
That's true.
I'm sure there's others, though.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The conventions are behind us and there are now 9 weeks until Election Day, so it's crunch time for the campaigns. We've got plenty to discuss today. First off, we usually expect candidates to receive a bounce in the polls after their conventions, so has that been the case this time around? Also, there's been plenty of speculation in the media that unrest in places like Kenosha and Portland could reshape the presidential race and hurt Biden. So we're going to look at what the evidence says so far. And finally, there's a high-profile Democratic primary in Massachusetts on Tuesday where Congressman Joe Kennedy is challenging Senator Ed Markey for his seat. In Ed Markey's 47-year political career, he's never lost an election. But also, no Kennedy has ever lost an election in Massachusetts. So here with me to discuss all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, everybody.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Galen.
And senior politics writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Good to see you, Galen.
Good to see you, too. So let's dive right into the convention bounces. Nate, does it appear that the conventions, both of them, the Democratic and Republican, have they affected the race at all so far as we can tell at this point?
It's not that easy to tell, I don't think. So taking them one at a time, with Biden's convention, in general, the polling did not seem to show much of a balance. I think he went from like plus 8.4 in our polling average to like plus 9 point something, right? So maybe half a point or a point. But we didn't have a ton of polling conducted in between the DNC and the RNC. All the polling we did have was online polling or robocalls, meaning no kind of live caller polls, which is important because live caller polls tend to show bigger swings. We can get into the reasons for that or not, but like generally speaking, like when you see like a big traditional convention bounce, it's from like a Gallup poll or a CNN poll, a live caller poll, and not like an online panel survey. But Biden didn't seem to get much. Now, did Trump get a bounce? There's a little bit more evidence for that. So for example, Morning Consult, right?
The number of times you've said that on this podcast.
Well, you know, you play the greatest hits on this podcast, Morning Consult or Morning Consult. I don't know, everybody. But like that organization, as well as YouGov, put out polls that seem to show Trump getting like a 3-point bounce roughly. There are other polls, you know, Harris X didn't show a bounce. The LA Times poll has not shown a bounce so far. There was some weird Zogby poll that I think did show a bounce. And so it's like, it's a little ambiguous. The evidence so far seems to be that Trump helped himself a little bit, but not for sure. It may wind up being a lot or not at all once we get better polling in. He did not seem to help himself so much in terms of like favorability. So you look at like favorable numbers for how do you feel about Joe Biden or Donald Trump. It looks like Biden's kind of improved a little bit and Trump's did not. And so if you have the theory that like, hey, what's going to be durable versus transient out of these conventions, that Biden softened his image a little bit and Trump did not help his. But basically, you know, we haven't had, by the time you're listening to this, we probably will have had a high quality live caller poll or two. And therefore, to be honest, that will probably become the discussion and will subsume whatever else we've been talking about and become the new conventional wisdom. But like, as we tape this at 11:45 a.m. on a Monday, we don't have that much polling. And we therefore have like a vacuum of evidence into which like bullshit, bad hot takes flow in, you know, like pundits who I haven't heard from since like 2011 are like, are coming in the vacuum, giving you their hot takes about Kenosha and shy Trump voters, right? It's all complete bullshit. Doesn't mean we know what's happening. It's just that there is like very little evidence right now and a lot of speculation.
All right. With that, let's move on and talk about the unrest in Kenosha and Portland, because a lot of the analysis has centered around that more than maybe even the conventions. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Ready to make the smartest choice for your business? Say hello to Shopify, the global commerce platform that makes selling a breeze.
Whether you're starting your online shop, opening your first physical store, or hitting a million orders, Shopify is your growth partner. Sell everywhere with Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. Turn browsers into buyers with Shopify's best converting checkout, 36% better than other platforms. Effortlessly sell more with Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and supports global brands like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen? Join millions of successful entrepreneurs across 175 countries backed by Shopify's extensive support and help resources. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Start your success story today. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Shopify.com/538.
Conflict between the Black Lives Matter protests and Trump supporters became violent over the past week, and I'm just going to run through a bit of a timeline of events. So early last week, Kenosha police shot Jacob Blake, a Black man, repeatedly in the back, which was recorded on video. Protesters responded, many peacefully, and some by destroying cars and buildings and throwing fireworks at police. Later in the week, a 17-year-old from Illinois was arrested and charged with several crimes, including intentional homicide, after he appeared to shoot and kill two protesters and injure another. His motives are being investigated, but reporting so far shows that he idolized police, attended a Trump rally, and was part of a Facebook group that planned to go to Kenosha with firearms to protect property. The unrest has since subsided in Kenosha. In Portland, there have been nightly protests since the killing of George Floyd, with some turning destructive, launching fireworks, and throwing objects at police near a downtown courthouse. On Saturday night, a group of apparent Trump supporters drove through downtown Portland, firing paintball guns and pepper spray at protesters. Around 9 p.m., gunfire erupted, and one man was killed. The man's identity hasn't been released at this point at 11:45 on Monday morning, but according to reports, he was wearing a Patriot Prayer hat, which is a far-right group in the Portland area. No information has been released about his assailant, and we're waiting for more reporting and any arrests. So those are some of the key details. And over the past week, Republicans featured unrest in cities as a prominent part of their pitch during their convention. And some in the media have speculated that these protests and clashes could hurt Biden's standing in the race. So I want to discuss what we know and what we don't know about how the public is reacting. Of course, we don't have data following the unrest in Kenosha and Portland to a large extent because this just happened. But what do we know about the public response to the Black Lives Matter protests up until this point and whether or not it is reshaping the race?
So what we've seen in the polls, like around late May, early June, after George Floyd's killing and the protests around that, was support for Black Lives Matter had been about 10% plurality, meaning like more Americans supported Black Lives Matter than opposed it, but it was a gap of about 10. During the time in like around June 6th, that those numbers shifted a lot, where you had at some point 56% of people supported the Black Lives Matter movement, according to civics polling, and only about 28%, around 30%, disapproved of the Black Lives Matter movement. So you had a big increase in support for Black Lives Matter, so you had a sort of a decrease in opposition to it. But over the last couple months, those numbers have come back to where now Black Lives Matter's net approval is about where it was before George Floyd's death. So around, so it's like plus 10, much so it's lower than plus 20 or plus 25 in the middle in the early June. So Black Lives Matter support has went down, and mainly what you see in the polling is that Republican opposition to Black Lives Matter has went way up, and that's not surprising because Republicans are attacking Black Lives Matter more, and also Black Lives Matter has pushed some ideas, most notably defunding the police, that are actually pretty unpopular. So that's not surprising to Republicans. And you've also seen among independents, Black Lives Matter has gotten more unpopular as well. There could be some independents who vote Republican, there could be some who are centrist, there could be some who voted for Clinton or voting for Biden, so that you've seen that change as well. In general, among white Democrats, Black Lives Matter support is still the same. And then overall, from the start of the protests in early June until now, Joe Biden around the start of the protest was ahead by 6. And according to the most recent, our polling average right now, Joe Biden's ahead by 8. So there's not been, up to now, the protest around George Floyd, at least, did not seem, even though they got more aggressive and more unpopular with the public, they did not hurt Vice President Biden's campaign. It seems like voters separated those two things. We'll now have to see what's happened these last 10 days and if that changes the polls. But one other note on this, on August 17th, before the convention started, our polling average had Biden ahead by 8.4. It now has Biden ahead by 8.1. So up to now, at least, we haven't seen much evidence of a shift in the race. But again, the polls sort of post-RNC, post-Kenosha, we have very little polling data at all.
So why has there been speculation among some in the media that there will be negative consequences for Biden and Democrats in the election? Claire and Nate, if you want to weigh in on that. I know it's speculation about speculation, but from what we can understand by reading reports, where is this idea coming from?
I'm not sure. And one reason why I'm not sure is kind of based on what Perry said earlier, which is that when we had kind of a similar period in June, early June, where number one, like now in early June, the coronavirus numbers were getting better. And then you did have looting and violence in some cities, including New York, in early June. And Trump came out and held his Bible in Lafayette Square. And like that actually was associated with Trump declining in the polls and Biden opening up what to date is kind of his biggest lead. So it's a little bit unclear. I think there are a few things to think about, though. One is that people may be kind of mistaking a convention bounce, like we talked about before, for having to do with Kenosha and Portland, where in general you expect convention bounces. We weren't sure what to expect because of the virtual conventions this time, right? But if Trump goes from like -9 to -6 or -7, it's actually like it's not clear that that's good for him because you might expect a bigger bounce. Like our model will probably treat that as fairly neutral. But if you want to weave a narrative around some semblance of data, then you can say, oh, this proves that Kenosha or whatever is having an effect.
I think it's a reaction to the Republican convention was all about, especially a couple of the days, chaos in urban areas. And now, you know, in reporting after the fact, we've now found out that some of these people who were featured in the RNC videos, particularly of people in New York public housing, they didn't know that they were going to be part of a promotional video for the president at the RNC. So some of the programming that was involved in the RNC that painted cities and frankly like the residents in them black and brown as being the victims of crime waves over the summer. You know, and it's true, crime is going up in cities over the summer for many complicated reasons, which we're not going to get into here. But there was this idea that that was the Trump narrative about the conventions, right? Was that these protests are actually a sign of terrible disorder in American cities. All of that is kind of, you know, there's lots of historical dog whistles in America. So I think what we're seeing happen in, as Nate said, this vacuum of solid information, you're seeing people react to the narrative of the RNC, to the thesis of the RNC. So the thesis of the RNC was, these protests are terrible. They're terrible for America. We're tying Joe Biden to these protests. Therefore, the media or, you know, cable will say, will Joe Biden's numbers go down? Now, a thing that's really interesting is, for lots of reasons, Joe Biden has not, many of them having to do with the pandemic, Joe Biden hasn't really like been out marching at a Black Lives Matter protest, right? Some of that is, I think he's an older man, right? And he doesn't want to endanger himself. But also, I have to think that someone on his team is saying, okay, Joe, we're playing this a little safe, right? And playing it safe might mean not directly tying yourself to a protest movement that, yeah, is like controversial to some people. I also think it's, you know, it's as the stats that Perry cited earlier about approval numbers for the Black Lives Matter movement going down, kind of the further and further George Floyd and George Floyd the person and the incident gets in people's rearview mirror. Unfortunately, that's human nature, is that these movements become detached sometimes from the thing that had really initially incited the human interaction. So I mean, I think it is kind of narrative filling in for any real empirical knowledge that we have this week.
And I think part of what's going on is the general sort of conventional view of American politics is that Republicans won the 68 election in particular, and maybe the ones in, say, 72, 80, sort of running on law and order, tough on crime, maybe kind of anti-black people to some extent. So this conventional view of those elections is maybe that when the election is about sort of racialize issues that helps the Republicans in a majority white country, and the Republicans are better at that kind of election. And in 2016, maybe they won that kind of election as well. So I think there's a lot of recent history that I think maybe is like overinterpreted a bit, but still history that suggests that maybe this is a, it's probably good for Trump that the question is like, are cities having too much violence, as opposed to, is he handling the coronavirus well, or did George Floyd deserve to die? So in this sense, like any subject shift, the subjects we've been talking about for like most of the last few months are just bad for Trump. So this subject, I would argue, might be sort of closer to neutral for Trump. So I think that that's like worth considering as well. And I do think the electorate is not the same as 1968, but I might submit that some of our, or even 1988, but I might submit that some of our pundits are older, are sort of stuck in that. The electorate has changed. It's much different in terms of college education, in terms of non-white voters, but I do think some of these pundits are still sort of seeing, like, Trump might win this election, I have no doubt, and this issue might help him. I think this is going to be true. I still don't think a Law and Order campaign is exactly the same in 2020 as it is in 1980 or 1968.
And it's not the same when he is the incumbent, right? Usually you say, okay,
correct.
Everything is on fire right now. Blame the incumbent. Well, that doesn't work for Trump. And the sense in June, again, that like, oh, everything, hey, COVID plus looting, right? Everything is kind of falling apart. I mean, that was not a good period in the polls for Trump. I mean, I definitely agree, Perry, that like the media is kind of buying Trump's framing on this. And I agree, Claire, that people may have been primed by the convention, right? You get kind of 4 days of a relatively well-crafted version of the GOP messages compared to Trump impromptu. And it kind of primes people for thinking, and I don't know. And also, like, you know, let's also be honest, right? There is very little professional disincentive and psychological disincentive to say, oh, hey, like, Trump's got a pretty good shot here. You know what I mean? Like, that will make you seem wise. And like, you know, if he wins, then you look smart. If he loses, you say, well, we did say it was toss up, right? So not too surprising. There's no incentive to be the person who goes out there and says, oh yeah, Joe Biden's got this, right? Which I think is also not accurate. I think it is fairly uncertain.
Well, also, we've talked about this on the podcast before, that in the press, yeah, there may be left biases, but there's also a bias towards covering a campaign that feels competitive, because that will get people more interested in the race. And so to the extent that you can say, well, it was a terrible summer for Trump, but things seem to be turning a corner because of the unrest in American cities, from a narrative perspective, from like literally narrative as in the story that Americans follow through the news, that seems like a more compelling story than just, okay, well, the race has been pretty stagnant, and it still seems somewhat stagnant, plus a convention bounce to some extent.
Yeah, no, it's boring to say, oh, it was 8 points, it went to 9, and now it's 7. You know, that's not very exciting. We'll see what happens on election day, right? That's not very exciting. So I totally agree with that, Galen.
And also another interesting question is, like, the Biden people that I talked to, the Biden staffers, have always said, we don't think we're going to win by 10 points. The race is going to get closer. So I thought some of those polls, I think there was some polls over the summer showing Biden ahead by 15. I sort of was making fun of those at the time. And so I do think, like, Trump, I always assumed, was going to get between 42% and 46%. Hard to really get below that. Probably hard to get above that. Maybe I'm wrong. But so in some ways, like, some tightening happening may have less to do with the events that are happening and more have to do with, like, 46% of people voted for Trump in 2016. I assume a lot of them will end up coming back to Trump again. And so I suspect some of what you're seeing in the polls is like undecided people who voted for Trump may end up coming back to him. And I think that's sort of like, it's going to be hard for us to tease out, is this based on events? Is this based on strategy? Or is this based on sort of like where some of the natural patterns the electorate was going to go? It was hard for me to see Biden winning 52-38, but we had polls saying that in part in June.
Yeah. Perry, you mentioned previously the 60s and 70s a little bit in terms of relying on historical precedent to understand our current times. And during the past several months, during the protests, we've seen some academic research cited multiple times, essentially suggesting that peaceful protests, particularly peaceful protests that see a violent response from police historically in the 1968 election actually increased Democratic voter share in surrounding counties, while violent protests
actually increased Republican share of the vote in surrounding counties. And this is research from Omar Wasso. So when we look at that, I mean, to what extent should we use that as a template for understanding the current times versus, you know, the country has changed a lot. And in 1968, the incumbent was a Democrat.
I'm leery of that for two reasons. One, because the demographic changes in the country, the changes in racial attitudes in the country. I don't know how, like, 1968 was a long time ago. I don't know how to, anywhere to say that. And I guess the second thing I might say is part of the issue is I think it's to disentangle who exactly is attacking who and which protests are violent. Like, literally, I'm having trouble figuring out exactly what happened in Portland right now. And we have, like, you know, very different media narratives about it. And we have very bifurcated media itself. So figuring out, disentangling who is inciting who, and then figuring out which voters believe who is inciting who is going to be, I think, fairly challenging to determine. I think it's going to be hard to say this is a violent protest from the Black Lives Matter people versus this is a violent protest people from the anti-Black Lives Matter people versus this is a violent action by the police. I think it's going to be fairly hard to disentangle in these next few weeks.
What's so interesting, I mean, we were talking, Perry, I think you said earlier that a lot of the commenters are people who are older. I mean, the Trump campaign also seems to be acting from like an older person's playbook in the sense of, I was so struck at the convention by all of the talk about suburbs, which really seemed to just like go back to these 1968 battles over federal housing and, you know, the George Romney versus Richard Nixon integration of the suburbs. And there is this idea going back to like the suburban housewives of America, to use the Trump phrasing, how those people feel about the Black Lives Matter movement. Maybe those white suburban housewives are getting slightly more tepid about the movement, but on the other hand, they probably know Black people who live in their suburbs now, right? It's not this like totally foreign specter that it was in the late 1960s in some places around the country, which is why some of the strategy seems so odd. You know, you had that St. Louis couple talking about they want to destroy the suburbs, you know, talking about, I mean, it's essentially alluding to like Section 8 vouchers and like letting the other into the suburbs. It's just like a very, it doesn't play on the more nuanced way that people, I don't even know how to put this, talk about race or talk about like how they want to keep their neighborhoods the same, whatever that means. You know, a lot of that fight comes down to like schools and busing and stuff like that. Those debates are still alive and well in America, but there's less kind of the housing talk that the Trump campaign was using feels very retro in this way that I wonder if that mindset won't continue to hurt them in the next 3 months.
Well, here's the other point that Perry, you brought up at the beginning, but I want to kind of dive into, which is that, yes, support for the Black Lives Matter movement has decreased. And polling also shows that Americans increasingly say that they see the protests as mostly violent as opposed to mostly peaceful. So there's still a plurality that say mostly peaceful, but the number of people who say mostly violent has been increasing. At the same time, we haven't seen that result in worse head-to-head polling for Biden, right? And he said in statements over the weekend, and also he's expected to give a speech around Pittsburgh today on the violence and basically denouncing it on all sides, etc., and challenging President Trump to do the same. He also had a Twitter storm over the weekend, President Trump, that is, in which he seemed to give some support to his supporters who are going into Portland, even some support for the 17-year-old apparent vigilante in Kenosha. So how does the response from the president and the Democratic nominee shape what happens going forward? And what else should we know about how they're responding?
Part of what's going on here is, my sense is the Trump campaign is smartly sees an opportunity here, which is to, they're trying to goad Biden into, you must condemn the protests, you must condemn the looting. I think they're trying to get Biden to attack the protests in a way in which he attacks also the Black Lives Matter movement, which will irritate part of his party. So I think Trump is smartly trying to get Biden to like come so far on the side of like the violence, the protesters are too violent, that it'll irritate rate, you know, the sort of younger and black people who are out in the streets who don't really like Biden in the first place, who are Democrats, and sort of create an inter-party battle. That seems smart to me, actually. I think that's part of what Trump is trying to do there. I think you have a Democratic Party that is somewhat divided, where like the John Kasich Republicans are not super excited to be voting with the Ilhan Omar AOC crowd. And so I think they would like Joe Biden to condemn certain leftists whenever they could. Like I saw over the weekend, there was an urge for Biden to have a sister soldier moment. I think there is some urge in the sort of Biden coalition to have Biden attack somebody on the left to show how citrus he is, because they like that. So I think there is a tension here in terms of like, I think Biden is in a place where there's a lot of hard choices here to be made, and the sort of like how exactly you precisely condemn the violent protesters but not the, and you condemn rioting without condemning the peaceful protest. This is not the easiest line to draw. So I think there is something. I'll be curious to see what Biden says the next few days. And I think the issue is more complicated because some of the protests are happening in Portland, which in the popular imagination is a white city. But some readers emailed me telling me Portland actually is more diverse than you think it is. But Kenosha is definitely a racialized conflict, and so I do think that Trump is going to go there tomorrow. We think so. I do think that the country is majority white. Trump, I think, does have some sense of what sensibilities are around these issues. So I think this is a tricky issue for Biden to seem appropriately woke without being too woke, for lack of a better way to say that.
It's almost, I've started to think about Biden knitting together those Kasich Republicans with like squad fanatics as kind of, sometimes you'll watch those like TV entertainment channels and they'll be doing these red carpet interviews, and it's just a study in how to give a softball interview, right? Like you think of Biden as like the celebrity being interviewed on the red carpet, and the two camps, the Kasich Republicans and the like the more liberal parts of the Democratic Party, they don't want to ask him any hard questions that will bring up an answer that they don't want to hear, that they know will make some people angry. And so like that whole side of the election, and frankly, like that's why the Biden's convention was all about what a nice guy he is, what a nice man Joe Biden is. So you're seeing everyone kind of tiptoe around that. And Trump is doing this thing, which he did in 2016, which is this tactic of, we're not trying to win you over, we're trying to like depress your enthusiasm about Joe Biden. So like Trump wants to ask the hard questions, the like frankly valid questions, which people were asking about Biden in the primary, about his record on race and like, is he too clumsy and non-evolved on race? If you poke too hard into a lot of, you know, like older white Democrats' records, you find problems with race or things that don't hold up in 2020. But it is an interesting dynamic. And Trump, if we know one quality he has, it's that he will always go there.
Nate, do you have thoughts on how the response is shaping up so far?
I find it a little bizarre that we've kind of had a news cycle about like, oh, is Joe Biden denouncing the protests loudly enough? Because Joe Biden has never like, or denouncing the violence loudly enough, right? Because Joe Biden's like never promoted violence, which President Trump arguably has. You know, President Trump is the president. Joe Biden is not. I mean, it's kind of, I think, a little bit of a but her emails moment in some ways. At least in the case of Clinton, you had like some degree of wrongdoing and it became a giant thing. But like, if one of the candidates, number one, is president, and number two, right, you have literally these kind of caravans of like Trump cars and vans, people with Trump paraphernalia driving from rural Oregon into Portland. It results in somebody being killed, someone who I think was on the Trump side, so to speak, right? Like, it's not great to have these kind of violent confrontations in the streets, but Trump kind of retweeted video of the Trump vans coming in and seems to be, you know, his advisors have said, like, actually, we think if these things get violent, that's probably good for us politically. So I think the media is fucking this up pretty badly.
So the quote I'll share actually from Kellyanne Conway on Fox and Friends, yeah. She said, "The more chaos and anarchy and vandalism and violence reigns, the better it is for the very clear choice on who's best on public safety and law and order."
I mean, that's despicable. I mean, I don't have a high opinion of Kellyanne Conway to begin with, but that's a despicable quote. Obviously, there is violence on both sides. I think there has been sometimes people are using the euphemism protest when they should be referring to violence, and sometimes vice versa. That's a tricky thing to get right kind of editorially. But you have one candidate whose official strategy it is to kind of say, yeah, this is good for us electorally if violence occurs. And Joe Biden's saying none of that. And like, I don't care if it makes you seem like a partisan to say that. Like, the media's job is to make that clear to people that, like, you know, if one candidate's electoral strategy now is, we hope that you ignore the pandemic that has killed 180,000 Americans because maybe there'll be violence that will be good for me politically, even though I'm the incumbent. I mean, that's like, that's number one, an admission of a lot of weakness if you want to be very horse racy about it. But number two, just kind of disgusting.
It has put the media in a bad position. I will say that. I don't know. I've been kind of thinking about this the past couple of weeks and been a little bit like depressed about it because I've been hearing people, you know, I was in Ohio for the past couple of weeks and I heard people say stuff about like, you know, the tone of NPR, right? Like life, like it's too in the tank. It's too liberal. And when you listen to NPR, like, you know, especially right now, a lot of what they're saying, you have to fact check on the fly. You have to accurately describe protests that are valid protests, but which sometimes turn into violence and destruction of property. And there's this host of particular 2020 pitfalls in the course of like reading the 5-minute, you know, morning news that happen. And it does put you in a really difficult position to describe, you know, I'm sure all of us on this podcast have received things about like, you sound too liberal, you know, you sound too, like, I think it's less and less right now, you sound too conservative, in part because watching the RNC was a little bit of like a divorcing yourself from reality because the pandemic wasn't really mentioned that much. And when it was mentioned, it was often mentioned saying untruthful or misleading things about it. So it does place everyone in a really tricky spot, which again, the Trump campaign means to do, right? Like it's not that it's not smart on some level. It's just that it might be immoral.
Yeah. And look, I'll just say, like, if you've listened to this podcast, like, if you're somehow listening to this episode of the podcast and you haven't listened before, I don't think we are a podcaster. I don't think I personally am someone who is afraid to call out the media for many different types of biases, including liberal biases in some context, right? But, I mean, just the whole notion, I guess we're kind of falling prey to it, of, like, kind of treating Kenosha and Portland as some, like, horse race strategy question. I mean, even that's a little bit, I don't know if it's immoral or what, right? But like, you know, and I think Claire's right that like part of what Trump does is like to trigger this reaction where the media will pearl clutch and get up in arms about things. And that can give you other things to point toward in terms of bias or whatever else. But like, but out of the various issues that have come up with this campaign, this is one where I don't think there should be a lot of moral ambiguity about kind of who is rooting for what. And there is, I think, unfortunately.
I mean, so I agree with all the media critique that was just given. And if I were in charge of the media, I would sort of change how the coverage is done. I do think in this context, knowing sort of what media norms are, I'm skeptical they're going to change. And based on the last 4 days, I'm more sure than ever they're not going to change. So in this environment where one candidate semi-promoting violence and the other candidate renouncing it will be covered as Trump is for law and order and Biden is for civility, I think that's going to be the dynamic that exists, even if I didn't wish it so. And I guess I do wonder if, and maybe I'm wrong with this, and we'll see, if black people protesting a lot is always a net negative for the Democratic Party. I was surprised in June or July when Biden's numbers stayed high despite large numbers of black protests. I was surprised by the polling showing people liked them. And I will be watching Trump's strategy the next couple weeks. I kind of think it might work. So I'm open to the idea that it won't, not because of media coverage, but just because of, honestly, how Americans see racial issues. I guess that's what I'm open being educated, but I'm watching carefully to see what happens.
I think that's a good thing to point out, which is like that it was, a lot of people were saying this feels different because it's more of like a multiracial protest, but also support. And who knows how long that continues. The thing that I think will be, that has struck me about this election so far is how you know, at the RNC in 2016, there were a lot of speakers from families who had family members who'd been killed by illegal immigrants. And we had the whole thing about like American carnage at the inauguration. And there is something so, and we were just saying before about like, you know, Kenosha and the killing of George Floyd. These are all about the worst events in a family's life or the death of a human being. And the fact that that's what this election, that like political parties are spinning election strategies based off of those events, there's something almost like tabloidy is wrong, right? Because those are real and important stories. But the prurient interest in spinning, well, what, like, did Jacob Blake have a knife? And like, was George Floyd actually like in a fight with a cop who killed him? Like, just the tabloidization of kind of the way we look at the political race is deeply uncomfortable, because like tabloids thrive off of what? Sex and death. These deaths are, you know, they obviously feed into bigger issues, but there's just something very distasteful about using people's personal tragedies to spin an entire election strategy off of. It's funny, I was reading this essay in Vanity Fair from like 1999. It's called The Tabloid Decade. And it's about how in the 90s, American society lost all substance and it just became all about tabloid scandals, right? It was about Bill Clinton and like the Pee Wee Herman sex scandal and all this other stuff, you know, like, and darkly, like the 2010s are kind of tabloidy, but in the different way, in the kind of like murdery sort of way. And I just think there's something really dark about the way that these campaign, I mean, the Trump campaign strategy basically is playing off of these terrible events.
I mean, it's bad and it's dark. I would say, though, that George Floyd's family spoke at the DNC and sort of referred to police brutality. And then at the RNC, you had the head of the New York Police Union endorsing Trump and praising him and basically saying one party protects law enforcement, defends law enforcement, and the other doesn't. So in some ways, like, these issues are very partisanized right now. So I think it's natural, and I think it's unfortunate, but I think that's where we are. And I sort of feel like, to some extent, we are having a much more racialized election than in 2008, even though two white guys are running. Like, the election is centered on these racial issues, and to some extent, Trump is the pro-police candidate and Biden is the pro-black and pro-police candidate, and that's a real divide, I think, in the American electorate.
For sure. Maybe a better way, I agree with all that. Maybe a better way to say what I'm thinking is, like, this election, even more so than last election, feels like it doesn't deal with what we have typically thought of as national issues. But it's almost like every city, if you turn to, you know, section B of the newspaper, the metro section, it's all about the police and crime. And it often has very racialized subtext, right? So it's almost like the national election has become about Americans' views on communities and crime and policing in this way that feels very local and very particular and like close to people's hearts about like, well, this is how much, maybe this is for the better, you know, right? Where we're actually talking about things that like affect people's daily lives. But it does feel so very different from, I mean, when they talked at the RNC about school vouchers, I was like, whoa, that's the first time I've heard a Republican talk about, frankly, like a non-protest. It felt like this anomaly of the substance of old campaigns or the substance of like what national politics used to be about. I'm not saying like that we should go back to that. I'm just saying like it feels much more visceral and localized in the way we're having it now.
Well, in many ways, the news cycle has been driven by a man who had his finger on the pulse of the New York tabloids for decades.
Completely.
And has, yes, you know, for whatever else you can say about Trump, he certainly has a sense of what drives people's emotions.
Right. And he took out an ad saying that the Central Park Five, who were obviously later very famously found to be innocent, should get the death penalty, you know, and he put that in all the New York newspapers. So he's certainly familiar with all of that.
I do want to move on and talk about this primary race in Massachusetts tomorrow. This has been an insightful and thoughtful conversation. I appreciate everyone's contributions. So let's talk about this Markey Kennedy race. But first,
hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy has been challenging Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey for his seat in a high-profile Democratic primary race that gets decided on Tuesday. Kennedy is 39 and Markey is 74, although Markey is arguably further to the left than Kennedy, but this race is complicated. So, Claire, kick us off. What are the contours of Kennedy's primary challenge to Markey? What kinds of messages or issues are being debated?
Well, I think the first thing to know about this race is it's one of those primary races that has become nationalized, which, again, I think is a trend in general in the past couple of years following the AOC primary. But Markey is the incumbent. He is, you know, an older white Massachusetts Democrat who has, in the course of this campaign, and frankly, like the past couple of years, done a, I would say, pretty successful rebrand in the manner of Bernard Sanders to be like an older man who is an ally of the young progressive. So an older progressive who channels the policy goals of the young left, most notably the Green New Deal. Markey has been very supportive of AOC and her, her quest to get a Green New Deal pushed through, whatever that means, right? And I don't mean that derisively. I mean, it's a very general umbrella plan. But anyway, that's how Markey's kind of made his bones. He is being challenged by Joe Kennedy. Yes, that Kennedy, grandson of Robert. He is, you know, young, handsome, redheaded. He's kind of doing the Kennedy thing. He, in this, you know, a lot of people think he is running for this particular Senate, in this particular Senate primary, because he wants to avoid, this is all getting very complicated, he wants to avoid running against Ayanna Pressley for a future Massachusetts Senate seat. So Kennedy is kind of this, he saw this as his chance. And Kennedy, as far as like, you know, what constituent groups they're all kind of going for, Markey has been endorsed by AOC. Kennedy has been endorsed by Pelosi. Markey is kind of winning the progressive Twitter vote, I would say. You know, liberals, young progressives. Obviously, Massachusetts is a pretty liberal state, so and is a pretty wealthy state, particularly in, you know, the areas around Boston. Although, then you also have areas around Boston that are very white, working class, Catholic Democrat, which is a whole other vibe. Kennedy is doing pretty well with those people and also with voters of color, and particularly in the Boston area. There's a lot of generational stuff. There's a lot of hereditary political dynasty stuff. Should I stop talking? Have I given a good enough picture of this? There's a lot of things to talk about in this race.
I guess I'll just throw this out there before we dig any deeper. Is there reliable polling for this race? I know primaries are hard to poll, but is it clear who's leading going into tomorrow?
Yeah, Markey soon to be behind, but has pulled ahead in the polls by margins in the high single digits, generally speaking. So he's the favorite.
So Claire has described a situation in which this has become a nationalized race that is symbolic of the cleavages within the Democratic Party. Is that a fair characterization of what's happening on the ground with the different constituencies that they're speaking to, or has that dynamic flattened everything?
It's not clear that you can really talk about this race in ideological terms because they're both running as kind of on the same policies, right? I mean, it's just like Kennedy is just like, I'm a Kennedy,
well,
and I'm entitled
actually
to the seat, right? Like, that's just,
that's,
I mean, am I being too flip?
That's a blunt characterization that he obviously is not using.
No, that's like the message. There's no other message, really, right? He's younger and more dynamic, right? There's no real message. I've scoured his like campaign materials. I'm like, there has to be something apart from just I'm a Kennedy, but there isn't really anything.
Yeah, I guess I'm not totally disputing it. It's like, well, keep going.
No, that's all I have to say, right? But like, there's amazingly, he's not running from either the left or the right relative to Markey. It's just, I'm younger, and we need new leadership, and, you know, K-E-N-N-E-D-Y. That happens to be my last name.
I think he is, yeah, the youth part is part of it. I don't think the youth thing is totally irrelevant, but it's a big part of, like, what Kennedy seems to be saying to me is that I'm younger and that I'll be a more dynamic, more of a national figure. Like, Markey is not Elizabeth Warren or Bernie. Markey has up to now been a sort of, like, less-known senator. Kennedy's been saying, because of, he's implying that because I'm young and he thinks he's charismatic, I would debate that. But I think that he's saying that I'll be a more interesting figure. I'll get more name ID. I think Nate is actually correct. Is my sense is, and Claire is too, my sense is Kennedy is running, A, because being a senator makes it easier to run for president. And then B, I think Claire is hitting something interesting. Is that I think the conventional view is that if Warren retires, Ayanna Pressley would probably run for that seat. And my guess is a Kennedy would beat Ayanna Pressley. But again, Kennedy wants to run for president. And I don't think it'll be a great move for him if he can beat old guy Markey instead of Ayanna Pressley. That's right. A great incentive
it's
to do
It's a less
that.
Awkward. It's a yes. Much less awkward race to win.
When he flies to South Carolina to run for president, that he beat, you know. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's not going to be like, well, yeah, I took the spot of this up-and-coming black woman who was already like a rising star in Boston. Yeah, I mean, you guys are right. Like, Nate, you're right. He is running to be a Kennedy. I would also say that, like, the things that have become, like, issues in this election are very, very, like, local, though, in some ways. Like, Kennedy has had a couple flubs about, like he got... I'm going to mispronounce this, but the Quabbin Aqueduct or the Quabbin Reservoir is this thing where it basically like displaced these towns. And Kennedy had this email from his campaign where he said, well, Markey isn't representing these towns. And it turned out that these towns had been filled up by this reservoir. They no longer existed. And then this morning he misspelled Worcester as in Worcester, Massachusetts. Which is not spelled Worcestershire. Like Worcestershire sauce. It's spelled like Worcester.
It's spelled W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R, but he put an H after the C. Is that correct? Yeah.
Correct. That's correct. Not to be confused with Worcester, Ohio, or Wooster, W-O-O-S-T-E-R. Anyway, so people got mad about that. It's like, oh, Kenny doesn't even know how to spell Worcester, or Kenny doesn't even know that these, you know, whatever. So there's been some missteps there. Then I would also say, like, people, like, Markey has been getting criticism from the black community in Boston. There was a black family whose family member died has been very vocal about Markey being unhelpful, about using insensitive language with them. Markey, way, 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 way back in his career, was, frankly, like a lot of white Democrats, not for busing initially, which I think... You know, probably if you talk to like older black voters, they might remember that, right? I mean, Boston has a very, very complicated, maybe it's not even that complicated. Boston is a sort of, if you talk about like northern white ethnic racism, Boston kind of comes up there. I mean, there's this great 30 Rock joke that I always like to use about Boston, where Jack Donaghy's mother says she's playing cards with the other ladies with the other women from Our Lady of Reluctant Integration. Great joke and very telling about Boston. So I think there's a lot of also dynamics at play underneath the surface between these two like white Irish guys. I assume Markey is Irish, but maybe that is unfair on my part.
I think this race is not interesting based on these two candidates who have very, you know, one old guy senator, one Kennedy, both have similar views. But I love, and I'm interested in the role of Pelosi and AOC in this is actually more, as a proxy fight for their 2 years long fight,
right.
This is actually a great race because Markey was one of the head, it was sponsored the Senate version of the Green New Deal, which of course Pelosi has been trashing for 2 years. So because Markey supported the Green New Deal, AOC endorsed him and said, it's not about whether you're young in terms of age, but in terms of whether your ideas are young. And so AOC has been in a bunch of Markey ads, and AOC is not necessarily popular in America and not even necessarily in parts of New York, but has helped Markey win the younger and the college-educated vote in Massachusetts by having AOC really strongly behind him. And then you had, a couple weeks ago, Pelosi, who has been generally discouraging primaries in the House, jumped out, and surprising to me even, jumped out and endorsed Kennedy over Markey and sort of has really got involved in this campaign on behalf of Kennedy. You know, she knows Kennedy better, is my guess, because they're in the same chamber, although Markey was a House member for a long time. So the fact that Pelosi and AOC have jumped into this race of two guys who are both Democrats, there's no electability questions, there's really not much policy difference, but it's a sign that I think this proxy fight is going to continue and has been sort of a fascinating part of these 2 years.
Out of curiosity, given that you've described a proxy fight between, you know, two sections of the Democratic Party, is this an open primary? Can only Democrats vote, or can independents and Republicans vote if they like?
So their presidential primary is a modified primary, which is kind of in between closed and open. I think that often means that independents or people who are unaffiliated can vote, but not people of the other party. But I don't know if their Senate primary is different.
All right. Well, any closing thoughts on the race tomorrow? I mean, in the grand scheme of things, will the result be important either way?
No. In the grand scheme of everything else going on in the world, I think it's not very important.
No, only in the sort of proxy, yeah. Like the two guys who are going to vote with the Democrats on every bill are going to vote, you know, one of them's going to win. Yeah.
You know, what if someday Kennedy becomes president? Then it will have been very important, no?
Ivanka Trump versus Joe Kennedy.
Ivanka Trump versus Joe Kennedy.
It's the Fair enough. Election America deserves.
As I mentioned, no Kennedy has ever lost an election in Massachusetts, but Markey also has a perfect record when it comes to winning his election. So we will see what happens on Tuesday. But let's leave it there for now. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Also, subscribe to us on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.